give me some time to receive the message of being free.
Let's have an AA meeting.
Let's have one.
My name is Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Lisa.
Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NADA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. I asked this young lady, Kristen, to speak tonight. I remember her when she came in, and I know she's part of an awesome home group that a lot of people that I respect their sobriety are in. And so I look forward to Kristen's story. Thank you, Lisa. Hey, everybody. My name is Kristen, and I'm an alcoholic. I feel really tall tonight. I have on high heels that I don't normally wear. I'm wearing a dress that I wouldn't normally wear, but this is what I was taught to do in AA. So, yeah, I'll just get some things out of the way. I have a sponsor. I have a home group, which is a very, very important part of my sobriety. My sobriety date is March 17th, 2018. That is not my original sobriety date. My original sobriety date was May 5th, 2012, but I'll tell you more about that later. So I'm going to share my personal adventures before and after. I like that part and how it works, because what it really does, as Lisa was just reading in that part that she just read, the way that we connect with each other is through our stories and through our personal experiences. I couldn't identify as an alcoholic until I heard some other people describe themselves as alcoholics, and I could identify with how they drank, and more importantly, how they felt when they were drinking, or most importantly, how they felt when they weren't drinking. And for me, that's when my alcoholism really shows up, is when I'm trying to not drink without a solution. When I'm trying to stay sober on my own without a solution, without a sufficient substitute, I fail miserably. I failed miserably when I was trying to drink, when I was trying to manage my own life while I was drinking. That was a disaster. That was a train wreck. But the way that I felt on the inside when I stopped drinking, when I tried to make myself stop drinking and stay away from alcohol and try to act like a normal person with normal feelings and do normal things, that was a train wreck too. That was a disaster. I hated the way that I felt when I wasn't drinking. But that was before I came into AA and I realized that there was a solution and then there was a different way to live my life. So just, I'm not going to get too much into my childhood. That was a long time ago and I don't remember a whole lot of it, but I grew up here in Atlanta. We moved to Atlanta from D.C. when I was 6 years old, when I was in the first grade. My parents are not alcoholics. My dad was a preacher. My mom was a teacher. So it was a very modest upbringing, very modest childhood. But I don't remember ever lacking anything. My parents always provided for us. My parents were good parents. We moved down here, like I said, from D.C. when I was six. I had started the first grade up in D.C., and then we moved down here, I think it was October, and I remember that day. I remember that very first day walking into the first grade and not knowing anybody. I burst into tears. I started crying. Everyone was staring at me. It was humiliating. I was 6 years old, and I remember that day. It was very painful. But I do remember that self-consciousness, feeling like people were staring at me, and I was so concerned that nobody would like me. I was so concerned that I wouldn't make any friends, and you know, that feeling kind of followed me into adulthood, and I still can feel like that today. I don't necessarily think that that's alcoholism per se. I think it's just part of being human, but I do find myself getting consumed with that sometimes. And it doesn't seem like other people feel that way. Like, I look at other people and they seem calm, cool, and relaxed and comfortable in their own skin, and I can't make that congruent in my head sometimes. Like, I feel like other people feel better than I do, but that's probably not the truth. So when I was 11, my parents told us that they were going to get divorced, and I was devastated. And that was, that was 1982, and I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any friends at the time whose parents were divorced. That was a source of humiliation and embarrassment for me, and I did not want anybody to find out that my parents were getting divorced. I thought it somehow had a reflection on me. I thought it somehow had made me a kind of person that people wouldn't want to hang around or be friends with, and I don't remember where I got that idea, but that's just part of, that insecurity that I felt as a young child. But I remember distinctly feeling like, this is awkward. Like, I can't believe my parents are getting divorced. Why would they do this to me? How can't they tell that I'm devastated and this is affecting me in a way that I don't want it to affect me? And it wasn't until I got in, much older that I realized that my parents should have never gotten married to begin with. It was the best thing for them to get divorced. I don't remember. I remember a lot of fighting. I remember a lot of there wasn't any physical fighting, but I do remember a lot of arguing and, my brother and sister and I having a hard time falling asleep at night because my parents were screaming at each other. I do remember that. So in hindsight, it was best that they got a divorce. But at the time, it was a source of humiliation and embarrassment. And I remember not wanting anybody to find out and keeping that a secret. And not that that has anything to do with my alcoholism. My parents getting divorced when I was 11 does not make me an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic is that my body reacts differently to alcohol when I start drinking. And when I start drinking, I can't stop no matter how hard I try. But all of that I'm just sharing that with you a little bit about my childhood to say that I feel like, as far as I can remember, I've always felt kind of uncomfortable in my skin, even though I might not act like it, even though I might act like I'm, great and I don't care what anybody thinks. I still remember feeling that way, and I can get that way sometimes too. Fear is a big motivator for me. Fear still exists in my life today. I can recognize it now, and I can identify it when fear creeps up, but that's as a result of working the 12 steps and working with a sponsor and being honest with people in my network. Before I came into AA, I wouldn't have been able to identify fear in its many forms, anger or resentment or identify the ways that I manage my fear or the ways that I behave when I'm in fear or have the potential of being in a situation that's uncomfortable. I know all of that is fear now, and I know that there's a prayer in our book, God, remove my fear and direct my attention to what you would have me be. I wouldn't have thought to turn to God and asking him to remove my fear. I wouldn't have thought that that was a reasonable thing to do. When I get in fear, I feel like I'm in a lot of danger, because when I get into fear, that's when I want to manage things. I got to take this fear, and I got to manipulate situations. I got to make sure that people do what I need them to do so that I can have the outcome that I need so that I can feel okay. And that's usually how I deal with fear, but today I can recognize that. Anyway, back to my story. So I didn't really start drinking until I was in college. When I was in high school, high school was a really good time for me, and actually one of my really good friends who was speaking at our meeting on Saturday said the same thing. She was talking about high school and how she really enjoyed herself, and I had a great experience in high school. It was really, really fun. I was really concerned about my grades. I was really concerned about being in the marching band. I was really concerned about, hanging out with people who were going to achieve things in life. I hung around with people who wanted to do activities. Like, I was on the yearbook staff. I was in the concert band. I was in the marching band. I was in the honor society. I wanted to do all this stuff, and I felt it was good. It was fun. We had a really good time. I had a lot of friends that did the same things that I did. I think there were probably a lot of people that were going out and, sneaking out of the parents' house and getting drunk and doing things that I wasn't involved in. It just wasn't on my radar. I never thought to – now, my brother is a different story. I found out later, he used to sneak out of the house all the time and go down to Midtown, ride MARTA down to Midtown with his friends and skateboard and do all this crazy stuff, and he got in a lot of trouble. But it was never even – I never even crossed my mind to try to sneak out of the house and go do something that I wasn't supposed to do. I was always where I said I was going to be. I was home when I said I was going to be home. I was with the people I said I was going to be with. I don't know what was wrong with me. but that was that was before I discovered how alcohol could work to make me feel okay. That was a long time before I started drinking alcoholically. But all of that to say, I didn't have an experience in high school where I drank a lot or got into a lot of trouble. I went to college, and I didn't do a whole lot of drinking in college either. I remember my freshman year, I went to college far away from here in a different state. But I remember my freshman year, one of the girls on my dorm room floor had a blender, and we weren't supposed to have alcohol on our dorm floor. But one of the girls had a blender. We made strawberry daiquiris, and my roommate like threw up all over our room. This is like the second week before, it was like right before school started. It was like my second week of college. My roommate threw up strawberry daiquiri all over our carpet in our room, and that was pretty much my experience, my first experience with alcohol and drinking too much. But I don't remember a lot of consequences because of my drinking in college. I feel like I drank like a normal person, like a normal college student. You know, I still went to classes. I joined a sorority. I did a lot of things that I felt like were probably pretty normal in college. And even in my early 20s, I feel like I didn't drink I didn't drink alcoholically. I didn't have the obsession. If I remember correctly, and I could be totally wrong about this, but this is my perception. It wasn't until I was in my, so after I graduated from college, I came out. I discovered that there was something different about me, and I came out. I realized I had always had those feelings, but I got into a relationship with somebody who didn't drink, so I didn't drink. And that lasted for about 5 years, but it wasn't until my early 30s, I think, when I started drinking, and I don't even know what happened or why this happened, but I'd been working like a responsible human being. I had a couple good jobs, but here's another thing about my employment history and kind of my emotional immaturity. I feel like I probably could have done a better job being a young adult and being a college graduate and being a responsible human being. I really don't like responsibility that much. I can interview well. I'm really good at getting that interview, and I can talk a good game. Here's a good example. When I graduated from college, I interviewed for a job at the local CBS television station in Indianapolis, Indiana. I was not qualified for that job. One of my majors in college was sort of related to television communication, sort of. I wasn't really qualified for that job, though, but I interviewed for it. I had, I don't know, three or four rounds of interviews, but I got that job. I don't know why. I talked a good game in the interview. I made the guy believe that I was qualified, but as soon as I got that job, he was disappointed because I would show up late. I was not the same person that I was during that interview. I was not the same person that he thought he was hiring. I would show up late. This was way before cell phones. This was in like 1993, something like that. But I would just, when we're supposed to be rehearsing, the way that they set up the news broadcast is, you know, there's somebody, you work the cameras behind the scenes, and there's like a soundboard, and there's the teleprompter, and people have responsibilities. You're supposed to participate and pay attention when they're filming the news. I wasn't always reliable. I remember one time my job was to move the teleprompter so that the news anchors could read. I got lost in thought, and I was just like not paying attention. And all of a sudden, they cut to commercial, and my boss comes out of the sound room and is like yelling at me. He's like, "What's wrong with the teleprompter? What is wrong with you? What are you doing?" And I was like, "What?" I just things like that. Like, it was just, I was just so consumed with myself and so consumed with things that were going on around me that I didn't pay attention at work. I didn't concentrate on being a good employee. I didn't want to be responsible. Responsibility didn't seem desirable to me. I wanted to be able to go around and tell people that I worked at a television station, but I didn't really do a good job when I was there. So, you know, that's a common theme throughout my story. Like, I would get good jobs, but then once I got the job, I wasn't really a good employee. I didn't do a lot of the things that they were expecting me to do. I didn't really pay that much attention. I would do the minimum amount just to get by, just to not get in trouble. You know, and if I think about it now, I wasted a lot of good years. I could have a lot more money in my 401k right now than I did back then if I had just paid attention and been responsible. But, you know, paying bills and being responsible and all of that stuff is just, I don't know, I didn't get it. It wasn't appealing to me. I'm telling you this because what I discovered about myself or doing my inventory and looking back, looking at myself as a sober adult, looking back at my young adult self, even before I started drinking, is that I'm always looking for an easier, softer way. I am an easier, softer way kind of girl. If there's a shortcut, I'm going to take it. If there's something that I can say or do to make you feel sorry for me or to let me off the hook, I'm going to play that card. I'm going to do whatever I have to do to get by with the very minimum so that I don't get in trouble or that you don't think badly of me. I don't really care that much about you not thinking badly of me. I just don't want to get in trouble or be held responsible. So I would get these jobs. I would work hard. You know, the first couple of weeks of a job is really fun. Like, that's like your honeymoon period. Like, going to orientation and getting trained and doing all that stuff is great. But after that, they start expecting you to do stuff and perform and be responsible, and I'm just not good at that. So I was really good at job hopping. Like, as soon as something got hard, I'm interviewing for another job. I'm bailing ship. I'm jumping ship. I'm doing something else. And that's been true throughout my relationships too. But anyway, back to my drinking. I didn't start drinking until I was about, this didn't start becoming a problem until I was in my, I don't know, early 30s maybe. And I know that's pretty late, but so I started drinking alcoholically in my early 30s. And I came into AA the first time through a detox facility, Peachtree Hospital. I was almost 41. So between the ages of 32 and 41-ish, I literally almost drank myself to death. So I didn't drink alcoholically very long, but I did a really, really, really bang-up job. I made up for lost time. And I'll tell you more about that later, but I was in really, 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 really bad shape. It's a miracle that I'm even standing here because of the way that I drank and the way that I almost ruined my body with drinking. But I couldn't stop. I was completely powerless. At first, when I started drinking, I'd gotten into a new relationship with my partner who's here tonight. We've been together almost 20 years. Some hiccups here and there. I did some things that made her want to kick me out of the house, which is understandable, but at the beginning, it was fun. Like, we would drink, we would go to concerts and, you know, do fun stuff that where drinking was involved and going out to dinner and all that fun stuff. But I don't know when it happened, but at some point I started requiring alcohol more and more frequently. And I'm not just talking alcohol. I'm talking shots of Jose Cuervo just to go to Target. Like, I couldn't. Seriously, we would get up on Saturday morning, and she would drink with me too sometimes. But I took it to the limit. I pushed the envelope. I couldn't function. I couldn't do normal weekend things without drinking first. And not only was I drinking all the time because I just needed it. I needed it to be okay. I needed it to do regular life things, but I also discovered that one of the things I really enjoyed doing was drinking and driving. Not just drinking and then driving. I mean, drinking while driving. And that is something I did on a regular basis. I've never been arrested. I've never gotten a DUI. I've never been in jail. I've never, fortunately, by the grace of God and some miracle, I never killed anybody or hurt anybody. I mean, best case scenario, I would get in an accident and hurt myself. Worst case scenario, I would get in an accident and kill somebody else. But that never happened to me. It doesn't, and it's not by any virtue that I possess. It's just how it happened, and just by the luck that I got sober when I did. If I'd continued to drink, I'm convinced that I would have continued to drive drunk, and I probably would have killed somebody. I'd probably be either dead or in jail by now, in prison probably. But that's something that I'm not proud of. I used to drink and drive all the time. But, you know, not having a DUI and not being in jail doesn't make me any less of an alcoholic. I'm very much an alcoholic. Fast forward a little bit. Trying to remember all these things that happened. I was doing incredibly stupid things while drinking. When I was drinking, sometimes I would be really fun and affectionate and happy and just carefree and, you know, super fun. But most of the time, and it seemed to happen more frequently, I was angry. I would get angry and belligerent, and I would want to fight, and I was really unpredictable. As my drinking progressed, I started to not want to go out. I didn't want to go out to bars, or I didn't want to spend the money to go out and drink in front of people. I certainly didn't want people to know how much I was drinking. I remember this memory sticks out to me. When I was way before I'd gotten sober, I was drinking and I was trying to hide my drinking, and that's very common too. I spent a lot of time trying to hide my drinking and trying to make sure that other people didn't know how much I was drinking. And I don't know about you guys, but if you've ever tried to pretend like you weren't smashed when you're really smashed, trying to focus and pay attention to what somebody's saying and trying to pretend like you're not drunk, oh my God. Takes a lot of effort, but yeah, so I spent a lot of time trying to hide that and make sure that people didn't know how much I was drinking. But I have a group of friends from high school that we still stay in touch, and sometimes we'll get together and go out to dinner. And I remember this one time I was drinking so much. I would have to drink before I went out to meet my friends for dinner because they drank like normal alcohol. They're non-alcoholics. They drink like normal people. So we would go out to dinner. This one time I remember there were, I don't know, six or seven of us. They ordered one bottle of wine to share between six or seven people. Kill me now. Like, that is horrible. I remember that feeling of trying to how am I going to get through this? How am I going to make it through this dinner with this much wine in my glass? And nobody wants to order another bottle. Nobody does. And I'm too embarrassed to, you know, order a martini or drink in front of my friends from high school. I didn't know it at the time, but that's the obsession. That's the obsession that the book is talking about. That's the mental obsession, and that's the part of this disease that AA is designed to treat. It doesn't do anything while I'm still drinking. It doesn't change my brain. There's no way to change my brain or the enzyme deficiency that happens inside my body when I start drinking, but this program treats that mental obsession. I didn't know that at the time when I'm sitting there with my friends about to crawl out of my skin because nobody wants to order a second bottle of wine, and they expect me to be okay, and they're just going to go home and go to bed like normal people do, and I'm about to lose my freaking mind. That is the worst feeling. And I got sober, too. Remember I was telling you about how my disease shows up when I try to stop drinking or when I try to moderate my drinking or try to control my drinking? I got sober right before, it was legal to buy alcohol on Sundays. So one of the worst things, one of the worst times that I remember feeling, and this didn't happen very frequently because I made sure it didn't happen very frequently, but this is a rookie mistake. I would sometimes forget to buy enough alcohol on Saturday to get me through Sunday. Oh, man, that's miserable. And I remember I would hide my go-to was vodka. You could get pretty good-sized bottle of vodka, pretty good bang for your buck. Vodka was my jam. And I believe the lie, too, that you can't smell vodka. You can totally smell vodka. You can smell vodka. If you drank vodka the way I drink vodka, you can smell it. But so I would buy bottles of vodka. When I was trying to hide my drinking, I would buy bottles of vodka on my way home from work, and I wouldn't go to the same liquor store two nights in a row. No. I don't want the cashier. I'm so concerned about what the cashier at the liquor store thinks of me. I don't want the cashier at the liquor store to think I'm an alcoholic. Crazy, right? But I would buy vodka. I would pour it in water bottles and hide it all over my house. And sometimes I would forget where I hid it. I would hide it in the refrigerator my partner could have opened any one of those bottles thinking it was a regular bottle of water and discovering that it was vodka, but she didn't. It got to a point, too, where I was taking bottles of vodka. It looked like bottle, you know, it looked like bottle of water, but I was taking bottles of water, vodka, to work with me because I couldn't get through the day without drinking. I know I'm kind of all over the place here, but I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to cram everything in, but this is what I looked like when I was drinking. This is what happened. It got to the point where alcohol was my master, as it says in the book. Alcohol ruled my life. I couldn't be okay without drinking. So I would manage the heck out of it by not going to the same liquor store twice, two nights in a row, buying bottles of vodka, big bottles of vodka, splitting it up, pouring it in water bottles, hiding it all over my house, making sure that I had enough on Sunday. If I didn't have enough on Sunday, I'd have to lie to my partner about going out. Oh, I'm going to buy groceries. There's a Mexican restaurant over by the Kroger near my house, so I would tell her I was going to Kroger, but I would go to the Mexican restaurant and do as many shots as I possibly could before she called me on the phone asking me what's taking so long. I would try to make sure that I didn't put all of my empty bottles into the recycling at the same time, because I'm really concerned about the guys who work for the sanitation department. I'm really concerned about what they think of me. I don't want them to think I'm an alcoholic. See, common theme here. I'm really worried about what people think of me. Yeah. So, you know, trying and I would get into a lot of trouble. I would drink mostly by myself at night. My partner she'd get tired of dealing with me, so she'd go to bed. I would come home from work and stay up till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning drinking by myself. And that's the way I liked it. I wanted to be alone. I didn't want people judging me. I didn't want people telling me how to drink or, hey, you should stop drinking. Don't drink so much. Don't do this. Don't do that. You act like a fool. I didn't want to hear that. So I just wanted to drink the way that I wanted to drink. But I still found ways to get in trouble by myself. By myself. I found ways to get in trouble, and I like to drink and text. That's very, very dangerous, drinking and texting. And I remember waking up, this is a terrible feeling too, like waking up the next morning out of a blackout, and this became a daily occurrence for me, opening my eyes almost every morning and just, after the fog settled, just thinking, what did I do last night? What did I say? Is my partner mad at me? She's probably mad at me. Is she going to ask me if I remember what I said last night? She probably is going to ask me, and no, I don't remember what I said. And then I'd pick up my phone, and I'd look through my outgoing phone calls. Who did I call? Who did I text? The worst is I'm not really on Facebook that much anymore, but I used to look at Facebook like, oh, my God, did I post anything stupid on Facebook? Delete, 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 you know. And that's humiliating, and that is not the way that normal drinkers behave in life. But that is the way that I behave. But like I said, the really horrible part, the really noticeable part of my disease, like all of that drinking stuff, like I could clearly see that there was a problem. Drinking is clearly a problem. Okay. How do I eliminate this problem from my life? The solution's easy, right? Just stop drinking. I'm just going to stop drinking. I made a lot of promises to a lot of people who were doing a lot of nagging. Well-intentioned people, but they wanted me to stop drinking. They wanted me to not die. I made a lot of promises to these people. So, of course, the solution is get alcohol out of my life. I'm going to stop drinking. Stop drinking. That's the easiest plan. That's the plan. Going forward, stop drinking. The longest time that I was ever able to go on my own without drinking was 2 weeks. 2 weeks. That's the longest time I could do it. And I was miserable. Like, I remember the pain, just the internal pain, the excruciating anguish of not drinking, and I didn't understand, like, how do people do this? Why would anybody do this? Why would anybody choose to do this? Like, I can't stay sober. So, like any good alcoholic, at the end of 2 weeks, I rewarded myself for not drinking by drinking a whole lot. and... You know, shortly after that, I started to have some really bad health problems. First of all, I gotten fired from my job. I don't remember the timeline of events, but I hadn't had any really serious consequences from my drinking until I got fired from my job at the end of 2011. And that was a long time coming. My poor boss, he tried to hang on. He tried to give me every reason, give me every chance. He one time pulled me aside and asked me if I needed to go, if I needed the number for the employee assistance program. And I was like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. But I was a terrible employee. I was a terrible employee, not because of the reasons like I was describing at the beginning of my story, but I was a terrible employee because I couldn't show up at the times I was supposed to show up. I was calling out sick. I would leave early. I wasn't useful when I was there. Other people were having to pick up my slack. So it's miraculous that I held on to that job as long as I did. But at the end of December 2011, I got fired from my job. I didn't really take any action at that point. I just kind of did nothing. I just laid in bed, and I would get up, and I was lucky to take a shower every 2 or 3 days. I would make sure that I was awake to be at the shady liquor store across the street from my house by 11 o'clock when they opened. So I was just drinking nonstop. I was drinking. I couldn't eat any food. I couldn't function. I would wake up, and you know, my hands were always trembling and shaking. I couldn't do anything. I didn't really want to do anything, but I started having some really bad health problems. I still wasn't ready to admit that I was an alcoholic. My partner and my mom took me to a gastroenterologist. I wasn't honest with him about how much I was drinking. I let him believe that I was having digestive problems. He took my gallbladder out, but while he was in there, because he's a smart gastroenterologist, he biopsied my liver. When I went in to see him, and I think my partner had had some conversations with him behind the scenes. So I think he might have been prompted to ask me this, but he's also a skilled surgeon, and he knows, you know, what normal healthy organs are supposed to look like. So I went in to see him in my post-op appointment, and he said he got it. I don't remember this clearly, but this is my perception. It felt like he was interrogating me. I was sitting in his office. He pulled up a chair. He's probably sitting, I don't know, 3 feet in front of me. He leaned up on his knees. He was real serious. He's like, "Miss Sears, do you drink alcohol?" And I was like, "No, that is so offensive to me. Why would you ask me that?" You know, and he's not a dummy. He knows what a compromised liver looks like. Anyway, so I lied to him. I wasn't honest. I wasn't willing to be honest with him about what was going on. He's like, "Well, you don't have..." He said, "You don't have liver cancer, you don't have cirrhosis, you don't have liver disease." He said, "But you've got scar tissue forming around your liver." He said, "If you don't stop drinking, the next time you come in here, we're going to be having a very different conversation." And I was like, unfazed by that. I went home and I found some vodka in my refrigerator and drank it. You know, it should have been a warning sign to me that my health was failing, and my health was failing. I really, truly believe that if I had continued drinking, I probably would have drank myself to death. I'm kind of running out of time here, but I'll fast forward a little bit. March of 2012, my partner and my mom kind of coordinated a little mini intervention. I ended up at Petra Hospital. It was not my idea. I didn't really want to go, but I was kind of at the end of my rope. I knew that something was up by the way that my partner was behaving that day. I knew it. I felt it. I had a sense that something was going on. Today was a little bit different. I had woken up that morning. I planned on being at the shady liquor store across the street from my house in time to get what I needed to get. But I knew something was different. I could just tell something was different. And sure enough, my mom showed up, and then half an hour later, my brother and sister showed up, and I was like, okay, whatever has to happen, I'm okay. I need to go. I need help. I know I need help. So I ended up at Petra Hospital, and they didn't have room for me in the detox ward, so they put me in the psych ward. But that's okay. That's where I needed to be. I don't know that I necessarily needed to be in the psych ward, but I needed to be there. I needed to be where people could help me. I needed to be somewhere that wasn't at my house. I needed to be somewhere where I wasn't in an environment where I was just drinking myself to death. I know I'm leaving a lot of stuff out, but I'm running out of time. So at Petra Hospital is where I was introduced to my very first AA meeting. I didn't stay sober that time, but I was introduced to AA. After I left Petra that time, my intentions were really good. I had a really solid, what do they call that? I don't know. This strategy that you come, they make you write down a strategy or a game plan. I can't remember the term for it. It's evading me right now. But What's that? Something like that. Something, yeah. But, you know, you have to sit down with a social worker. You have a member of your family come in. You sit down with a social worker and come up with your sobriety plan or your game plan or whatever. And, you know, I had all these big ideas. Like I said, I can talk a good game. I can tell people what they want to hear because I know what sounds good. I'm going to pass this test. I'm going to tell you that I'm going to go to AA meetings. I'm going to tell you that I'm going to go get a sponsor. And all that sounded really good. And it got me out of Peachford, which is where I wanted to be. But I did go to AA meetings some. I mean, we were going to AA meetings, but I wasn't doing anything. Just going to an AA meeting, not talking to anybody. I didn't have a solution. I was just going to an AA meeting. I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything. I didn't take any actions that would get me the result that I wanted. And so a couple months later, I was miserable again. I started drinking. I probably started drinking here and there before then, before my actual memory of ending up at Peachford Hospital a second time in May of 2012. But something kind of triggered for me that time. Something made me realize, you know, I have to do this thing or else I'm going to die. I'm going to die if I can't do something or change something. And my partner had also told me, if you don't stop drinking, you can't live here anymore. I mean, she kicked me out before. We had been in that cycle where she kicked me out. I'd do something stupid. She kicked me out. I'd go stay at my mom's house. You know, I'm 38, 39 years old, staying at my mom's house because my partner kicked me out. But this time I knew she was serious. There was something that felt different about that. Like, I felt like I got to do something or I'm going to die. So when I went back into Peachford that second time, I was introduced to the Fifth Tradition Group. They used to be able to bring meetings in every Tuesday and Wednesday night. We can't really do that anymore. Pandemic has kind of shut that down. But they used to bring a big group meeting, a big discussion meeting into Peachford Hospital every Tuesday night, and that's where I was introduced to the Fifth Tradition. That's where I saw people that were living this program and working a solution and were happy and looked like they loved their lives and looked like they were doing something worthwhile. And they, you know, they talked about having families and talked about having jobs and they talked about, you know, going to meetings and working with other people. And they had a relationship with this God. And I always believed in God, but I never thought to ask God to help me with this problem. Never crossed my mind. I would have never thought about that. And they were talking about, you know, how important it is to get a sponsor. And I remember in that one of those meetings, there was a woman that shared that night. And I don't remember what she said, but I remember liking what she said. So when I got out of Peachford that second time, I went to the Fifth Tradition Saturday night meeting. And I found that woman, and I asked her, and this is counterintuitive to everything that I wanted to do. I don't want to go up to somebody and ask for help. That's really humiliating and embarrassing. Kind of the same way that I'm embarrassed what the cashier at the liquor store thinks of me. I don't want to go up and ask for help. I don't want to seem like I need help from anybody. But, you know, I asked this woman, she'd be willing to be my sponsor. And she was like, yes, I'd be honored to help you. Thank you for asking me. And I was like, whew. And right then, honestly, I feel like that was a spiritual experience for me. I feel like that might have been the very first time that I felt like I'm going to be okay. This is going to be okay. I did something that I didn't want to do, asking another woman to help me. And she had very specific directions for me, which is what I needed. I needed some structure. I needed somebody to hold me accountable. I needed some things to do. I didn't know how to be sober or didn't know what to do with my hands. Like, what do you do if you're not drinking? And one of the things I had a really hard time with was I don't know what people do. Like, if you're not drinking, and I still sometimes have a hard time with this time of the day. But so when you get home from work, like between the hours of just say, I don't know, 6 and 11 p.m., you're not drinking. What do you do? Like, what do you do after work? I needed some help with that. I need something to do. I needed places to go. I needed to be around people that weren't drinking and living the solution and connecting with God. And I needed all of that. And that's what my sponsor gave me. So I asked her to sponsor me. She's like, yes, this is what we're going to do. You're going to call me every single day, every day. We are going to meet once a week. We are going to read through the big book page by page. Most of the time she was reading to me, but we would kind of take turns reading to each other. But we did. We read through the first 164 pages together, page by page. When it said pray, we prayed. When it said do this step, we did the step exactly the way that it was outlined in the book. She said, you're going to join my home group. We have our business meeting on Thursday night. You're going to come this Thursday night. You're going to raise your hand. You're going to put your name on the list, and you're going to join this home group. I was like, okay, what else? She said, you are going to call three other women in sobriety every single day. Not your friends that you got out of Peachford with. You're not going to call your friends that you were in Peachford with. You're going to call three women, established sobriety, sober members of this home group every single day, and you're going to tell them what's going on with you. You're going to ask them how they're doing. Okay, I'll do it, whatever. And I don't want to do that. I don't want to call people. That's embarrassing. That's humiliating, right? But I'm willing to do whatever it takes, any length to go to get, whatever it takes to get sober, because I was miserable. She said, you're going to pray to God every single day. I'm like, okay, I got that. That's no problem. I'll pray to God. I didn't have a problem believing in God. I always believed in God. But like I said, I didn't connect. She helped me connect the dots. She showed me how to work through these steps and connect with my higher power that I'm going to rely on to give me the power that I need to get through every day and to live happy, joyous, and free and to be a useful human being. And to be a service. Service is huge. Service is what saved me. I used to come to this meeting. Like when I was first getting sober, I was unemployed. I was unemployable. I didn't have a job for the first 10 months of my sobriety. So I had nothing to do except hang out with members of AA and go to meetings. Like sometimes I would go to three meetings a day, but that's what I needed. And I would come to NABA a lot. And I was all in. I was so passionate and enthusiastic about AA in the beginning. Like I could not get enough. I thought every meeting I went to, I thought everybody in here was on this spiritual pedestal. I thought you all had the answers and I could rely on any one of you to give me direction in my life. And but that's what I needed to think. I needed to think that I was surrounded by a bunch of people who felt the same way that I felt and who knew how it felt when I tried to stop drinking on my own. Running out of time. So I still have that same sponsor today. She was my connection at first. Like I said, it was really uncomfortable picking up the phone and calling women that I had never met in my life. But everybody was so nice and so friendly and so welcoming. I started going to my home group. It was really uncomfortable at first, really awkward. That is not what I want to do. I spent so much time when I was drinking just isolated. I was comfortable when I was isolated. I was comfortable when I was isolated and drinking. Coming to a meeting and interacting with people and introducing myself to people and looking people in the eye and having meaningful conversations, coherent conversations, was not something that I was used to. It was not comfortable at first, but that's okay. I pushed through it. And I sponsor a lot of women who tell me the same thing. Well, I'll come to meetings, but I don't really want to call people. I'm like, I know you don't want to call people. That's why you need to do it. We've all been there. We need to call people. We need to, you know, my sponsor explained it to me. Getting out of my comfort zone is the most important thing. And it's only hard the first time. You know, when I call somebody that I've never called before, it's only difficult that first time. Going to a meeting I've never been to before, sitting next to somebody I've never sat next to before is only uncomfortable the first time. The first day at work is only uncomfortable the first day. So if I can push through that and put my feelings aside, then, you know, there are so many rewards to be had if I keep doing the things that I was taught to do at the very beginning. You know, my sponsor is still a very important person in my life today. I have a network of women that I can call, very, very close to a lot of people in my home group. I've developed some phenomenal friendships. You know, we talk about things that people wouldn't talk about in other company. Like, I wouldn't sit down with my six or seven friends from high school and talk about the things that I talk about with you guys, talk about the embarrassing things that I did when I was drinking. They wouldn't know what to say. Like, they wouldn't know what to do with that. They'd probably pat me on the hand, like, bless your heart, poor little thing. But, you know, God is such an important part of my life. I can't imagine what my life would look like today. I pray all the time, and there are so many good prayers in the big book. One of the things that I repeat to myself on a daily basis is God, restore me to sanity. I use that prayer a lot. God, restore me to sanity, because sometimes I can get up in my head. I can still get, I am not perfect at this program. I still get really, I can get judgmental. I can get really irritable. I can get, yeah, judgmental is a really good word to use. But I judge everything. Like I'm really good at assigning judgment, or, you know, labeling things like, oh, this is bad, this is terrible that this happened. When it's not terrible, it's just life. It's just things happen. We live in a world with other people. We bump into other people every single day. We work with a lot of people. I work with, you know, people that I wish would behave differently, but it's, you know, I'm lucky to have a job. I'm very grateful to have a job. And now I can, instead of reacting or saying something that might hurt somebody's feelings or saying something I'm going to have to apologize for later, I rely on God for that stuff. I ask God to show me the right thing to say. Show me compassion. Show me how to behave with, you know, love and tolerance. And that's really, I believe that's really what God wants me to be. It says it in the big book. What God really wants me to be is patient, kind, loving, and tolerant. I don't have to do anything perfectly. I just have to be a human being and be useful. And some days that's all I can hope to be, is just useful. Some days I'm just in a bad mood. Some days things just don't go my way. But I am sober today, and I am so grateful that I don't have to wake up tomorrow morning and wonder what I did or said the night before. I don't have to scroll through my text messages. This is another story I forgot to tell. I'll end with this, but, yes, like I said, texting and drinking and texting was a big part of my life. I used to do that frequently. And at one point, before I'd gotten fired from my job, I had a work cell phone and a personal cell phone. I was so scared that I was going to text somebody, one of my coworkers, on my work phone at night when I, you know, in a blackout or something. I would literally come home from work, take the battery out of my work cell phone, put it in my drawer, so that I couldn't be tempted to text somebody on my work cell phone. Like that's crazy, right? But that's the way that I drank. That's the way that I almost destroyed my life. There's so many other stories I could have told you, but yeah, I'm grateful to be here tonight, and thank you for letting me share my story.
Thank you, Kristen. That was awesome. Appreciate your sincerity.
Give me some time to receive the message of being free. Give me some time to breathe. It's not that I don't wanna see. Understood your words to go ahead and forget my world. Oh, and I surrender, believing darkness could be a light. Oh, and I remember that all the dreams I made. And I tell myself not to cry. I feel like a long lost child.